time is about 10:15 or 9:15. With us this morning on the record are Representative Kelly, Representative Wyrock, Representative Hawker, Representative Curtula, Vice Chair Stoltz, Co-Chair Meyer, and Co-Chair Chenault. Today we will take up House Bill 488, Oil and Gas Production Tax, and with us online is Dr. Pedro Van Meers, Oil and Gas Consultant. Pedro, are you with us?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, that is really great. That is a difficult line a little bit from Algeria, but it is a great honor to testify again for the House Finance Committee, and I look forward to your questions and comments. If you like, I can just start out with a few brief comments.
Yes, if you would, Pedro, and then as questions or comments come up, we'll try to get those to you and hear your answers.
Okay, fantastic. To begin with, I must say the whole process through the House Resources Committee and the Senate Resources Committee in considering this bill, I think, has been a very enriching process. I believe many ideas are on the table that could improve the bill, and really I am very enthusiastic about, the final product that may actually come out. The question that a number of people have been asking me lately is, whether this, whether 2020 versus 2520, really would crater the pipeline. Would we see a situation that there would be no pipeline deal if 2520 goes forward? Now, as you know, my own analysis shows that there clearly is some difference between these two fiscal packages. What I think is very important here is that oil companies themselves really are the decision makers on this point. It is really not, although I can do economic analysis and I can advise, of course, the legislature on what the economic analysis seems to show, the important part is what do the sponsors think themselves, and I think it is very important to really review with them their views as to, whether there will be a pipeline or not if you go to the 2520, in particular if you go to 2520 with some progressive feature. So consequently, I think all I can say on that point is to encourage you to have intensive discussions with the and testimony from the oil industry on this very, very point. As I stated and as I have testified before, my analysis clearly shows that there is a difference. I testified before that under 2020 I can see an increase in activity. Under 2520, for the large companies like Anadarko and Chevron and Exxon and BP and ConocoPhillips, with 2520 I could see, about the same kind of activity. So I see a difference in activity and I see a difference in international attractiveness. But in the end, of course, it is up to the companies to decide, this whole matter of a pipeline. Obviously, with 2520, companies may take the position that they like to see a different gas contract or they like to start renegotiating, and all of that could lead to a situation where the contract is delayed or simply will not be entered in this legislature. But that is a question, I think, that really should go to the companies and themselves, because they are the ultimate decision makers on this. I think a number of very encouraging and interesting ideas, though, came up over the last 6 weeks, and I think I'm very encouraged by the creativity of the ideas that are on the table. Firstly, I think There is the progressive feature that was, of course, introduced initially in the House Resources Committee and was also considered and adopted in the Senate Resources Committee. I believe that a progressive feature in addition to the 2020 could be a workable package. I think it is very important to, realize that the point where you start to become progressive or the price at which you become progressive is a very important feature. Basically, in the House Resources Committee proposal, say this was based on a nominal price. That means a price that would not be escalated with inflation. And of course, it needs to be realized that if you insert this progressive feature on a nominal basis, that over time the value of that insertion point becomes less. For instance, if you insert if you start becoming progressive at $50, then, after 10 years with 2% inflation, in real terms of 2006, that becomes $41, and after 20 years, it becomes $34. So you should be aware of the fact that if you have a progressive feature based on a nominal system, that you have to select the price reasonable, because if you do it on a nominal basis, because the real value of that price will decline over time. And if you insert the price too low, then the progressive feature will start to overwhelm the fiscal package and it may make it quite unattractive. What is also important, I think, is that if you go for a progressive feature, that you should separate oil and gas. In the long term, gas prices in North America, at least so far, have tracked oil prices really well. But on a month-to-month basis and even year-to-year basis, as we have seen this year, gas and oil can diverge very, very significantly. And consequently, if you go for a progressive feature, I would suggest to have a separate scale for gas and for oil. Also, the clawback, the House Resources Committee, of course, removed the clawback. The Senate Resources Committee came up with the two-for-one feature, which I think is a very good feature to really ensure the maximum amount of commitment really from the large companies like the Anadarkos and the Chevrons and the really large companies. So I think that would be a good feature to consider. And I think that by, introducing that two-for-one, that should not be such a major change to the fiscal package that it leads to a breakdown. On the contrary, I think that should be a feature that everyone should be very positive about. There's also, I think, quite a bit of creativity displayed on, the small company allowance that was originally proposed at $73 million deduction. The House Resources Committee went for the tax credit. The Senate Resources Committee went for the 5,000 barrels a day formula that would then result in a situation whereby at 5,000 barrels a day, there would be no tax payable at all, and then going up to 30,000 barrels a day, there would be no, reduction of tax at all. I believe that 5,000 to 30,000 feature is a good feature. It helps the small companies. It doesn't help the really bigger companies, but I think it was designed for the small companies. The big companies would have the two-for-one feature, so I believe that will create, for both kind of groups of companies, an encouragement to invest. So that's basically really very short, the some initial comments that I would like to make about what has happened over the last 6 weeks, which I think was a very encouraging week, a very interesting period, and I am very hopeful that the bill can be enriched with the many good ideas that have been launched in a way that we have a better bill in the end and at the same time hold on to a pipeline deal.
Great. Any questions? Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Ramirez. I'll get the questions started here. We're kind of a shy group this morning. Anyway, thank you for joining us. And I just want to ask you a question concerning a comment I've heard. And that was that the comment I heard was that, well, let's go ahead and start at the highest possible tax rate. And then if we find out that's too high and we see that some of the oil investment is going elsewhere, we can always adjust it. Can you explain to this committee, though, that it may not be quite that easy because a lot of these major oil companies make their investments, you know, for 5-10 years out in the future because of the large capital that they have to put out for these projects. So if for, let's say, 3 or 4 years down the road, we find out that we're not getting the type of investment we want, and we were to then lower it, say, from 25 to 20, it could very well take another 4 or 5 years just to start getting these companies and their dollars back into the state.
Yeah, I would, you know, basically agree that that's correct. I have had a number of cases in the world where that precisely happened. You know, the most famous case, internationally very well-known case, is the country of Colombia, which, you know, at a certain point in time introduced a fiscal system that the country of Colombia had for a while very good investment. Then they adjust their fiscal system upwards. They lost the investment. Then it took about, as you say, about 5 years or more to get the investment back. And because once, you know, if you misfire, if you misjudge the level of taxation and it turns out that companies are indeed considering the overall fiscal package too tough, then of course they start to reorient their investment to other countries. Once that has happened, it is often very difficult to get, you know, the investment back, because, you know, then there is this negative experience, and then you have to go you know, much further to try to get the investment back. What happened in Colombia, for instance, was that, you know, after they had lost the investment, they actually ended up with a fiscal system that was more advantageous than they had in the first place. So you really then have to go overboard trying to get the investment back. So it is important to not misfire on the level of fiscal take, and to ensure that, you know, you try to target it right in the first place. Can the fiscal systems over time adjust? Of course they can. You know, I do not, as I also testified before, I do not see this as a very dramatic thing. The tax rate differences that we're talking about are relatively modest compared to what happened in other countries. But yes, the basic principle is true. If it turns out that you misfire and put the taxes up too high, then you know, any investment indeed leaves, then really it will take 10 years in total, I think, before you have your investment back on track, because typically it takes 4 or 5 years to realize that investment is indeed leaving, and then it takes a while to get it back. So countries have lost significant investment as a result of that. So there are some test cases around the world where that indeed happened. And you know, hopefully that will not happen in Alaska.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and the only reason why I bring that up is just to stress the importance of hopefully getting it right the first time.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, and then just a follow-up question. Other comments I've heard is that that you know Alaska is certainly a much more politically stable, safer place to operate than say some of the other countries that the multinational oil companies are working in. But if we even if we look at domestically in the United States, certainly there are other places. Much more economic to invest than Alaska. And I guess the one that comes to mind is the Gulf of Mexico and even the state of Texas, which currently produces more oil and gas than Alaska does. How do we stack up to, say, the state of Texas and the Gulf of Mexico?
No, as I presented in my rating, as I presented in my report of February the 14th, of course the Gulf of Mexico rates probably as one of the best fiscal systems in the world. So consequently, the fiscal terms the overall government take is very modest, the fiscal terms are very attractive, and consequently we've seen a lot of activity lately in deep water activity, particularly for oil. A large number of oil developments are taking place. So there's absolutely no question that, the Gulf of Mexico fiscal system would be more attractive than Alaska. The same would be true for the Alberta oil sands. As I indicated in my rating, Alberta oil sands would be far more attractive in overall fiscal burden than, Alaska in that particular case. So consequently, I identified two fiscal systems and in fact some others that would clearly be more attractive than Alaska. The experience in the world is that just because a fiscal system is more attractive than another fiscal system doesn't necessarily mean that all the investment goes there and another jurisdiction doesn't get any investment. That's not the way it works. It is just because, for instance, in the North Sea, we have had Norway and Britain side by side now for decades, with Norway typically over the last decade having a 78% overall tax rate and Britain starting out at 30, then moving to 40 and now moving to 50. So, and activity has been strong on both sides of the border in the North Sea. So, I don't want to dramatize that just because one fiscal system is better and more competitive than another fiscal system, it means that there is no investment in the countries with the somewhat, or jurisdictions with the somewhat tougher fiscal systems. But, of course, the level of activity will be affected. And obviously, the more attractive fiscal system, the higher the level of activity generally. There are other fiscal systems in North America that would be more attractive than Alaska would be. You mentioned Texas. In the case of Texas, it depends a little bit. Texas is a whole different series of different kind of systems because you have the state waters, for instance, which would be relatively tough compared to Alaska, but there are other spots that would be somewhat less tough. There are other jurisdictions in the world, as I also indicated, like Norway, like Russia, which would have tougher fiscal systems, and as we know, there is investment taking place in those areas as well. So it is a little bit of a gray area, but there is absolutely no question that the Alaska fiscal terms, as formulated, would be kind of in the middle of the pack. It would not necessarily be the toughest terms around the world, but for certain, it would not be the best terms either. And consequently, you have to be somewhat careful with the ultimate fiscal package that you introduce if you are clearly less competitive than some other areas in North America.
And thank you. For the record, Representative Foster has joined us. What Representative Weirach?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Peter, when we've got oil below $20 a barrel, what is your view on implementing a per barrel tax rate of, say, 35% to 75%? Is that reasonable?
Sorry, I'm not 100% understanding your question. You say if the oil price is $20 a barrel, would it be reasonable to have, say, a 60% government take? Is that your question?
Yeah, I mean, to look at the downside when oil drops below $20 a barrel.
No, what the whole PPT is supposed to do, and what it does, based on my economic analysis, is that at least for the next 10 years, under low prices, the PPT is clearly a more attractive system than the current ELF system. So, obviously, under low prices, Alaska, with the very low netbacks, the very high transportation cost of $5 per barrel, with the very low netbacks, obviously, every time the price declines, Alaska gets hurt almost more than anywhere in the world because the netbacks are so low and the wellhead prices are so low. But precisely one of the advantages of the PPT in terms of maintaining activity as good as possible under those conditions is that the PPT is a profit-based system. So if the price is low, obviously from an investor point of view, relatively speaking, the PPT is better than the current system. That, of course, then means that Alaska is running some higher risk, and Roger Marks previously presented a large number of graphs precisely calculating, how much the difference would be under different rates and different prices, but definitely the state of Alaska may lose $50 or $100 million, say, at low price levels if such low prices would occur and you would implement the PPT. So it goes both ways, but definitely the PPT is better for the investors under low prices.
Okay, and for the record, Representative Guerra has joined us. If you want to set up here, Les, you're more than welcome to. Any other questions? Dr. Van Meers, Representative Meyer earlier talked to you about Gulf of Mexico. Can you give us a little bit of idea on what the real tax structure is in the Gulf of Mexico? What kind of credits that the federal government provides for deep water exploration or other exploration credits that are provided in the Gulf?
The Gulf of Mexico actually works slightly different than Alaska would work. They wouldn't have the kind of tax credits that we are considering for Alaska. However, what they have done is essentially there are only two payments. One is a royalty and the other is the normal federal corporate income tax of 35%. So there is no severance tax at all. So there is no production tax at all, or an equivalent of the PPT at all in the Gulf of Mexico. So the only thing you have in the Gulf of Mexico is royalties and corporate income tax. Then with respect to the royalties, they have something that you could maybe call a royalty holiday for initial volumes of production. So, for instance, if you are in deep water on the first 87 million barrels of oil equivalent per lease, per field, you may actually have 0% royalty. So that means that on the smaller fields in the Gulf of Mexico, in some cases you may have no royalty at all and just 35% corporate income tax. On the larger fields, you would have royalties after you've achieved a certain level of cumulative production. So the way the federal government has encouraged activity in the Gulf of Mexico is simply by not having a production tax at all, and two, by lowering the royalties down to zero in the initial phase of production. And that, of course, creates a much lower overall government take, and that much overall lower government take, particularly with the very high wellhead prices in the Gulf of Mexico, creates a very, very attractive environment for investment.
Okay. Would you happen to know what the royalty is for...
Oh, 12.5% typically for deep waters, 16 2/3 for shallow waters. And as I said, on the 12.5, you may get a royalty holiday for the first 80 million barrels or something in that order of magnitude.
Okay. And so there's no... there's no state taxes involved, which makes it considerably different than what the state of Alaska is. I know I've heard some different conversations about Louisiana and other Gulf Coast states that are wanting a share of resource development there, and I don't know how the federal government actually takes care of them in that sense, but I'm sure there's a way they do.
Yeah, the situation is the same as with the state of Alaska, that is that at the state waters, just as in Alaska, in the state waters, the state fiscal system applies. And for instance, in the Texas state waters, which is just along the coast, the Texas fiscal system applies. And that, as I said, is actually definitely about as tough as the Alaska system. As soon as you get into the federal waters, very similar to Alaska, as soon as you go, say, deep in the Beaufort Sea or in the Chukchi Sea, then you have the federal system, and that federal system is based on the system that I just described.
Okay, and Pedro, could you comment? It seems like that in our conversations with the big three producers, doesn't seem like that they're as interested in the tax credit itself as they are with the 20% or 25% tax. And, you know, my concerns, I guess my question would be is we're trying to get them to invest in Alaska, but it doesn't seem like they're, as interested in the tax credit as they are in what the actual tax is. So would you have any comments on that?
No, my impression in discussing the matter of the PPT with the companies was not that there was not an interest in the tax credits. In fact, when the three sponsors proposed themselves a PPT, tax credits figured highly in their proposal. In fact, they were, you know, actually arguing at some time that in particular for heavy oils and for certain activities, the tax credits actually should be higher than the ones that are in the 2020 proposal. So I do believe that the three sponsors for sure are on board on the concept that tax credits are attractive and are an incentive to investment. I think the reason that they are focused right now on the rate is because that seems to be the area of discussion, and consequently, obviously, a higher rate means a lower government take, lower corporate take, and companies that are looking at you know, the large developments clearly the higher you go with the rate, the less attractive it becomes. So consequently, my clear impression is that companies are definitely interested in the tax credits, but of course the tax rate is also important for them. And I think the reason that there is so much focus on the tax rate now is that seems to be the debate, not so much the tax credits. But the tax credits was definitely an integral part of the company's own suggestions, and the fact that the companies in the agreement with the governor agree to the 20% credit as part of the overall package with a 20% rate, I think is an indication that they definitely see the 20% credit as an encouragement.
Okay. Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Chairman Chenault. Dr. Van Meers, in your introductory remarks, you mentioned a couple of times that, maybe it was for emphasis, that the oil companies are the decision makers on the gas line, and that maybe I was just reading too much into that, but does that lead, were you trying to lead us to any conclusion on linkages, or they, or just, or perhaps is it just inextricably linked by the, by you saying that? Just maybe comment, just because your emphasis on the major players being the drivers and on the gas line, and how that impacts, how that should impact our decisions on PPT, or your analysis.
No, the analysis that, you know, the plan, the way it has been, of course, kind of presented, and the way it is with the approval of the legislature may unfold, is that, of course, the first phase of the whole process is the changing the oil tax. And the oil tax is a standalone feature. And then, as a result of the agreement with the governor, the companies agreed to a level of oil tax and tax credits that they felt were consistent with bringing a gas pipeline forward. So consequently, we have an important piece of information, which is that at 2020, the companies and the, you know, are clearly willing to live up to the stranded gas contracts that has already been concluded. Of course, still some more work has to be done on some of the details like LLCs and so on, but some of the, you know, the basic package has been done. So I think the way the company see it, that if the 2020 is more or less there, they are willing to go forward with the stranded gas contract that has you know, been agreed to. Now, obviously, it is up to the legislature to decide on the taxes, on the oil taxes. If there are changes to the oil tax, I believe there are certain levels of changes to the oil tax that probably won't really impact significantly on this overall concept. And I mentioned some of them, like the 2-for-1 and the 5,000, and maybe a progressive feature provided that it starts at some reasonable high price. I can see myself that, you know, just based on the analysis that I have done, that the whole deal may still hang together at that point in time. Companies may still say, okay, fine, it's not 100% what was agreed to, but it's close enough, and we are going forward. Of course, if an oil tax is passed that in their minds is fundamentally different from the total investment package that they had in mind, then they may sit back and say, what do we do now? Because this means that the total investment climate, the total investment conditions in which we had thought the gas pipeline would operate is no longer there, or is now dramatically changed. And if that's the case, then all kinds of things can happen. Again, it is up to them to decide. It is up not to me to really comment on that, and that is why I suggest that you investigate that with them. But the companies could simply say, okay, it is high and we do it anyway. I would find that somewhat surprising. They may try to renegotiate the gas contract. I think that will result in strong resistance from the part of the administration. Or you may simply get a deadlock, and companies simply say, okay, we're not willing to go forward on this basis with a contract. So all these things may happen, and consequently, it is really like I'm just speculating about the things that may happen, but these are the kind of things that may happen. And that the sum total may be that you pass an oil tax law, but that no gas contract will be brought to the legislature during this, this year. Is that a possibility? Yes, it is a possibility if the companies feel that the total package no longer hangs together in their view. And as I said, I have given comments and I've testified to the legislature that I see clearly differences between 2520 and 2020 in terms of overall attractiveness, but how important these differences are, only the three sponsors can judge, and therefore I think it is a very important thing to review with them.
Thank you, Dr. Van Meer. Just a follow-up, you mentioned the scenario that they wouldn't build one by next year. What kind of recommendations might you have if we put in an incentive package and they didn't build it for 10 years? Do you have any suggestions of building in? We might have a different long view on incentives if the gas line isn't as imminent, and if it only goes like Alaska DOT fast in its movement.
Sorry, I'm not entirely clear about your question. You mean what happens if the gas line would not be introduced this year?
Well, Dr. Van Meer, just any guidance you might give to us for what if there's not a commitment to put forward a gas line for what if it's is some of the skeptics talk about there's just a long stall, and I'm just looking at the worst case scenario.
The worst case scenario is that of course an oil tax is passed that in the views of the three sponsors is not conducive to their long-term investment strategies in Alaska, and consequently they would then be hesitant to agree with the government to come forward with the gas contract. Or refuse to do so. Obviously, what that means is then the oil tax is there, you have the oil tax, and that is the law at that point in time, and then it just remains to be seen what happens. It could be that there would be no, gas contract put forward. It could be that they like to wait and maybe see whether this can be dealt with in the next administration. All these things could happen. The important part is really not for me to speculate on that because, as I said, they are the decision makers. They are the ones that need to give you clear answers on these questions. I think they need to kind of explain to you how they see the total framework, and consequently that is, I think, something very important to review with them. As I said, I have testified to the fact that I definitely see differences in competitiveness between one package and the other package, but it is up to them to judge how important these differences are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Crotula.
Thanks. Hi, Dr. Van Meer. Could you explain the two-for-one concept? I know it's been in Senate Resources, but we haven't had it in this committee yet. So could you just go over that a bit with us?
Yes, I think that the Senate Resource Committee came up with a very good formula, really. And that is the fact, as you know, there is the issue of the clawback. And basically, in the governor's proposal, it was agreed with the companies and the governor that that bill would contain the possibility, as was presented, that companies would have an ability to recover, say, $1 billion that they have spent over the last 5 years in the coming 5 years. And then in the House Resources Committee, that whole clawback was canceled. And obviously, if you cancel it, then Alaska is $1 billion ahead. And that would mean more revenues for Alaska if the companies, as I said, let's say $1 billion more revenues for Alaska in terms of the oil taxes. What the Senate Resources Committee came up with and said, no, really, you know, what is really important is that the three sponsors really show that they mean business 2020. Do they really mean business if there is 2020 that that they are going to invest, and consequently, are they really committed to Alaska? And one way to prove that is to say, okay, we allow you to recover that past billion, but or whatever the numbers is, this is different for each of the individual companies, but we only allow you $1 of extra deduction for every $2 that you invest in the future. So really what Alaska needs is a doubling of investment. That is really what Alaska needs. There is ample evidence that the production is declining. There has been about $1 billion a year investment over the last years. So we know that with $1 billion investment per year, we have a declining production. That is now the experience. So we need to probably double this level if we really want to reduce the level of decline or even eliminate it. That in turn then led to this, good Senate resources proposal where they said, okay, if companies invest $2, we allow them to recover $1 in addition to the $2 from their past expenditures, and consequently as an extra deduction, as an extra encouragement to double investment in Alaska. And that, I really believe, is a very good idea, because what Alaska needs is more investment, and this goes in the direction of trying to encourage more investment. But it would only apply if companies indeed do an unusual, or would only really create the full benefit for the companies if they really do an unusual effort to increase investment in Alaska, which I think everybody agrees is absolutely necessary.
Just a couple other things. Dr. Van Meers, did you see the New York Times article that was talking about the windfalls in the Gulf of Mexico and the fact that, at least in the New York Times opinion, that there were some, in their words, bureaucratic blunders that created some of those royalty reliefs, and that now there's probably action in Congress to end some of that? Have you seen any of that information? Do you have any comments?
I haven't seen it, but I am aware of the fact that, you know, at the federal level, the fiscal system of the Gulf of Mexico has been questioned a number of times. There are people that obviously, under the current very high oil prices, believe that that system may have to be reviewed. And consequently, there are definitely voices to that effect, and they have actually been there already for a number of years. So it is not new that there are certain parties that feel, or certain experts and commentators that feel that maybe it is time to review that system, but and that may happen, but it doesn't seem to be high on the agenda of the federal government at this point in time, because of the fact that, of course, the federal government looks at it from much more an overall national perspective. And with the very high prices of oil, it is precisely such an important concept for the United States to produce as much oil as they can domestically. So I think that's still the focus of the federal government, but of course I can't speak for them, and that's just my impression. But yes, you are correct that as a result of the very high oil prices today, there are a number of commentators that are commenting on the fact that there may be some merit in reviewing the fiscal system in the Gulf of Mexico.
Okay, thanks. And then if I could ask just a couple.
Representative Couture.
Thank you. I guess what you're saying, because of listening to your past testimony, where it seemed to me that what you were saying was between 2520 and 2020, we were still very competitive at both of those scenarios, that I guess what you're saying is at this point, the companies themselves are the ones that are making that internal decision. Is that what you're telling us about
how to approach that? Sorry to interrupt.
I spoke over you. That was the end of the question.
Okay. Yes. No, I have testified both in front of the Senate Resources Committee and in front of the House Resources Committee that, of course, in my analysis, I analyzed all the levels of taxation and all the permutations and combinations of tax credits and tax rates. And obviously, there is a difference in competitiveness between 2520 and 2020. And my analysis indicated that 2520 is about as the same as what we have today for the large companies such as Anadarko and Chevron and ConocoPhillips. And consequently, my conclusion was that this 2520, you would collect much more tax, but you wouldn't see much more activity. This 2020, you would collect, of course, less tax, and Roger Marks has given you all the figures on that. But at the same time, you would see more activity, because it would definitely be a more attractive feature if you believe in the fact that if economics improves, that you see more activity. So that was my assumption. And so I believe that this 2020, you're going to see more activity than this 2520. Whether 2520 in the total scope of things is so high for the companies that they feel that it is not worthwhile to pursue the gas line and bring a gas line contract forward, that is an issue that really, I think you're entirely correct in saying that is really an issue that the three sponsors have to answer on, and therefore I think it is very important to get a review of that with them as far as say the legislature is concerned, because obviously this is important information, and I can do whatever analysis I want. In the end, of course, it are the three sponsors that are the decision makers in whether they feel that an investment climate has been created by the legislature that is conducive to them agreeing coming forward with a gas contract.
Representative Couture.
Okay, thanks. Just finally on this issue, I recall in one of your earlier presentations asking you about, and it was about the tax credit versus the tax itself for new investors, and it was interesting to me that it looked like that the tax itself could rise very high and not have an impact because, again, my own thoughts were that it was the credit that was much more important, and this was for new investors. Do you recall that in your report and then your comment on it?
You are entirely right. That was a discussion we had, and that related to the $73 million initial allowance.
Right.
And obviously, in the governor's proposal of the $73 million allowance, if you don't pay any tax, then, of course, the higher the tax rate, interestingly, and the higher the credits, the more you can claim in terms of loss carry forward credits, and the more you can claim as credits for your capital investment. So if you base yourself on a flat $70 million, as was included in the governor's bill, for all companies, by the way, then this would be the effect. That would still be the effect for small companies if you go for either the tax credit proposal that was launched by the House Resources Committee, or if you go for the 5,000 barrels a day proposal that was launched by the Senate Resources Committee. What I like about the Senate Resources Committee is that it is kind of a sliding scale, and consequently it is more certain that only the small companies really will benefit from that, because there was never really very much of a logic to have a $73 million allowance for the very large companies. So I think the Senate Resources Committee came up with good ideas as to how to deal with that, I think. But yes, you are entirely correct that, if you fall in the small company bracket, then actually the higher the tax rate, the better, because you get more credits, you get more loss carry forward credits, and that is what was also shown in some of my economics. Obviously, with the $73 million case, if the price would go up very significantly, then you would gradually get into the situation where you have to pay the tax and everything started to change around. But yes, you are correct with respect to the very small companies on that somewhat counterintuitive point.
Thank you.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pedro, good day, sir. Just big picture sort of economic question on this whole issue and the body of testimony that I've been watching in both the House and Senate here. I guess fundamentally there's been a lot of testimony trying to certainly establishing premises that, in an environment of lower net effective taxes, exploration and development is encouraged and expands. In an environment of higher net effective taxes, exploration and development is discouraged and ultimately contracts. It seems also that the testimony on the PPT is that we would be establishing an overall net effective tax rate under most projected economic scenarios. And wouldn't it just seems to me that that syllogism leads to a conclusion that passing the PPT would result in then less exploration, less development in the state. Any comment on that sort of that broad syllogism?
Yes. No. There are the two features, and what is very important to remember is that there are two features. One is the tax credits, and the other one is the tax rate. What we're trying to achieve with the governor's bill was that, by both creating higher tax rates so that the state would collect more, but at the same time providing stronger tax credits, you would maintain kind of an economic balance, because it's not only the tax rate that is important, it's not only the government take in total that is important, it is also the whole structure of the tax that is important. So it was not just a change in rate, it was also a change in structure. And my economic analysis indicated that, yes, you could increase taxes, provided at the same time you increase the tax credits, and you would maintain the level of investment, or with the 2020 even expand the level of investment because of the tax structure. Now, some nations have been very successful at creating the right structure, and I mentioned, Norway already, but other nations have also the jurisdictions like Alberta and the oil sands and so on, and Azerbaijan in their developments of the Caspian Sea. Some nations have been successful by creating the right tax structure to indeed attractive investment, and particularly to encourage reinvestment in their jurisdictions. And that is kind of the focus of the whole PPT proposal, that we like to see more tax under high prices. We like to see higher income for the state of Alaska, actually significantly higher income, as we discussed, about $1 billion more, say, under current prices. But at the same time, because of the tax structure, if you stay relatively modest in your increases, you should see more investment. And under 2020, my studies show that I published on the 14th of February, that were published at that time, that you should see more attractive economics, and therefore, logically speaking, you would see more investment.
Okay. And I guess, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hawker.
And I guess, Pedro, I just, you know, as a layman, I fail to see how higher taxes, higher net ultimate taxes, can possibly encourage economic development.
Oh, the rationale for that is related to the entire cash flow. Or in other words, what basically happens is, yes, there is, you were slicing, let me re-explain this in a slightly different manner. My apologies. Essentially, profitability. What is profitability? If you think about the concept of profitability, the concept of profitability is not the total amount of profit that you have. The profitability is how much profit do you get for how much investment. That's really profitability. And consequently, what we're saying is, yes, you get somewhat less profits, but your net investment is also considerably less. So we are affecting the total balance between what you get and what you pay. And if you can pay less and get somewhat less, that could be a better deal than paying more and getting somewhat more. So consequently, it is this whole relationship between what you get and what you pay that determines whether an investment is attractive or not. And in that balance, the 2020 system is a favorable system, despite the fact that the state is actually better off in terms of total revenues.
And that what did you give, what did you get scenario, I mean, that's really the definition of the internal rate of return on any given investment. And again, I still fail to see how an increased tax rate, or I'd say net effective, not, you know, the tax rate, the increase in tax rates offset by a certain amount of credits, but it's still an increase in the net effective tax rate, how that could possibly result in improved IRRs.
It improves the IRR because of the fact that your after-tax investment is considerably less. So, you know, just to give an example, if you invest 100 and you get 200, let's say that is one rate of return. If you invest 60 and you get 180 as an investor, which means the government gets more, what this means is now you actually get three times rather than two times your investment, and that improves the rate of return. And because it improves the rate of return, there is more incentive to invest. Now, I'm not saying that rate of return is the only criteria. Net present value per dollar investment, net present value per barrel of oil equivalent. There are many other, you know, factors that companies look at. But rate of return is still important. And consequently, as I said, it goes to the heart of investing 100 and getting 200, which means you get $2 for every dollar investment, versus investing 60 after tax and getting 180, which means you get $3 for every dollar you invest. And that is what makes the system more profitable. And if you have an investment that is more profitable, you are likely to invest more.
Thank you, Pedro. Appreciate it.
Representative Meyer.
Actually, I'll yield to Representative Kelly, since I've already spoken once.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Van Meers, on the you ran several scenarios, and we've talked about the 2020 and the 2025. Would you talk to us a little bit about it? If the tax rate were to go up, and I'm certainly not saying that that's what's going to happen, but would you raise the credits to 25 as well, given what you know about the negotiations? And I've got a couple of others, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. As you know, my original recommendation, and that was actually in the report, was 2015. And then consequently, when after the information from DOR, we came to the conclusion that 2520 was a better package. The reason that my suggestion was to increase both tax credits and the rate was precisely we need to strike the right balance between tax rate and tax credits. Or in other words, theoretically, if the tax rate go up, in order to maintain the balance for investors, you would have to put the tax credits up as well. And that is why really 2015 was a viable package and 2520 was also a viable package. Now, the problem is you could theoretically say, okay, why don't we then go to 3025, for instance? The problem becomes that if you go to tax rates that are too high and tax credits that are too high, now the downside risk for Alaska becomes quite high because now the credits are so high that if there is a sudden collapse in price, the harm to Alaska could actually be quite significant. So we really had to balance the risk exposure of Alaska to these tax credits. The higher you put up the tax credits, the higher the risk exposure for Alaska in case the price collapse. And so it is only so far that you can push these tax credits. Typically, petroleum economists, you know, my colleagues also like Daniel Johnson and so on, we typically don't recommend going all out on the limb on these tax credits because it simply becomes too risky for a government. If we need to think about scenarios where the prices are low or where companies invested significantly and then the price collapsed, all of these things can happen. And if you push tax credits too high, then you expose Alaska to significant risks. And so it was also therefore that in the report there was some of that risk analysis, particularly for the heavy oils, because we considered definitely heavier tax credits for the heavy oils, and we came to the conclusion we just can't afford it. We can't afford tax credits that are so high that under downside cases, the state simply loses too much. And that was the reason why, you know, the 20% tax credit is really, I think, as high as you should go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of having both the gas piece and the oil piece in front of legislators, naturally, I prefer that we see both of them. And you mentioned a while ago that the difficulty on the company side, if there's a change in one, is they're going to be able to say, and I understand that, well, now that we see what this piece is, it changes what we're willing to do on the other, which pretty well shouts out that there is a connection between them, and I certainly believe that although we may have them unconnected in some respects, that in the final analysis on total return over time, they are connecting them. So isn't it something that would advantage us to have the same sort of situation, so that we don't go forward and then say, well, gee, if we'd only known what the other side of what the gas side was, and how you felt about that, we might have done this or we might have done something different. Any thoughts on that? Because it occasionally occurs to me that we should have that gas piece exposed at the same time we have this oil piece on the table, even if we're going to keep them separate until the consideration of joining them later. Any thoughts on that?
No, the way I understand the process is that, of course, is the end point of the process. The Stranded Gas Act did not permit fiscal stability on oil. And the whole reason that we are in this oil tax was because the companies wanted fiscal stability on oil. And we said, okay, if you want fiscal stability on oil, then we need to improve the regime and we need to have an oil tax that's really in the interest of Alaska. We don't want to stick with the current ALF. So the concept was to say, okay, let's first judge the oil taxation on their own merits, because that has to be a law of general application before it can be tied into a contract. Then there comes a phase whereby there will be a public review. Of course, in accordance with the Stranded Gas Act, there will be a public review of the whole package. Then the Stranded Gas Act and some other acts actually have to be amended before you can even consider the contract, because if you want to consider the fiscal stability on oil in the contract, then the Stranded Gas Act needs to be amended. And then finally, the legislature would have the view of the total package, the amended Stranded Gas Act, the contract, and the fiscal package on oil that has already been agreed to. So consequently, there is this whole sequence. In the end, the legislature is going to see the whole package, and during the process of amending the legislation, obviously the legislature can also give points as to what is necessary. As a result of the public process, the Stranded Gas Act specifically states that as a result of the public process, renegotiations may take place. They may not, but they may also take place. So it is expected, there is time reserved after the public process for a final finding. So really, much still can happen in this whole process before it's all finalized. And obviously, the Alaska public and the legislature both will have an extensive voice in how this whole thing is going to fit together in the end. And that is how it should be. And I believe that, therefore, you know, this sequence of events seems to be a logical sequence of events. Also from a practicality, certain aspects of the contract are still under negotiation and are still under discussion, like the LLC agreements and so on. So in order to make sure that the whole package can still be considered this year, this seems to be a very good timeline to try to get everything done. So that's the concept, and I believe that, therefore, the Alaska public and the legislature will have complete possibility to review the entire package before it is finally voted on.
I can see I haven't budged you a bit, but I appreciate your view of it. It's different from mine.
Another question, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kelly, for the record, Representative Jewell has joined us a while back. Go ahead, Representative Kelly.
On the Dr. Van Meers, on the complexity of this animal, we have a system where we're changing to taxing the net, and we've got some things in there for the little guys, and we've got some sort of a clawback or a two for one type approach. This and then just the very existence of the credits themselves within the system. How many systems like this are there out there? It seems to me that this is a very complex one, and we've spent quite a few We've had quite a few discussions about the difficulty of auditing and keeping this thing straight and not suing one another and making the lawyers rich for the next 20 or 30 years. How many of these things like this have you seen? And if you've seen others, how did they perform over time on this audit, keep and track element?
No, the concept, the reason that, you know, I recommended the PPT to the governor was precisely because from an international perspective, this is a very well established system. These kind of profit-based systems are all over the world. Many nations have been extremely successful with these systems. I mentioned Norway a number of times, but that's not just the only system. Britain actually used to use this profit-based system until the whole North Sea became extremely marginal. Australia is using this system very successfully in promoting their offshore, and so consequently, Newfoundland has developed, say, Hibernia, the big oil field in the offshore with it. The Mackenzie Delta in Canada will go forward on a profit-based system. The oil sands are now in a boom of development on a profit-based system. So there are countless examples around the world of jurisdictions which have been very successful with a profit-based system. And it is for that reason that the oil companies really didn't have much conceptual difficulties accepting it, because they knew it from everywhere else. The international experience is that, of course, if you have a profit-based system, that requires more auditing, more cost verification than, say, a gross revenue-based system. In fact, I'm phoning literally here from Algeria, and Algeria also has a very much a PPT system, which has been introduced this year. And in fact, as we speak, I'm assisting the administration here to establish the whole accounting system and establish the management information systems that are required to properly monitor this system. So consequently, it is a widely accepted system around the world. It is well known. Does it require some extra effort on the part of the government of Alaska to verify and ensure that they get the fair share from the profits? Absolutely. I think people like Dan Dickinson, who has extensive experience in this, I think have come up with very innovative ideas to limit and streamline the whole administration, and that was in the governor's bill. Some of these ideas were included in that, and also in the House Resources Committee bill. So consequently, I would urge you to pay good, you know, to review these processes very well. But I think, you know, the department has extensive experience, is well prepared for it. I think the best thing to do with respect to the implementation of this is to literally take the advice of the people that are supposed to do this. And I think by the time the final drafting of the law is going through its final paces, it is very important to really listen to the people that actually have to administer this law and take their suggestions as to what makes this law easier to administer and what does it take to streamline it. And I think there are good ideas on the table. These good ideas have already been included to a degree, and consequently that is important. Is it a very complex system? It is obviously more complex than the say ELF system that we had conceptually. Nevertheless, I think you are aware of the fact that ELF resulted in a lot of problems. In ELF has its own problems, like how do you actually define a field? What is a satellite field? What belongs to the real field? As you know, much problems around these issues. So just because you do things on a gross revenue basis doesn't necessarily mean that it is that easy to administer either. It puts a lot of burden on the administration to make the kind of decision that actually belonged to the ELF, and that resulted also in some problems, as you well know. So whatever system you take, there are always advantages and disadvantages in the administration. The reason that nations, through the experience over the last 40 years now, have zoomed in on profit-based systems is because they seem to be more reliable, they seem to be more responsive to important changes in economic conditions, and therefore they seem to be a fairer share for the jurisdiction all along as economies and prices and costs evolve. Obviously, the implementation of the legislation is important. Important regulations will have to be passed after this legislation, has passed. Important regulations have to be crystallized. All of that is important for it. But of course, that is well in underway now in the Department of Revenue, and people are considering all these issues at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of. You want to run me out of gas, or you want me to stop a while?
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pedro, on the issue, kind of a couple of what ifs. If in fact, from the state's point of view, we were looking at, well, we want to change the tax from 20 to 25, or we want to stay with 20 and introduce the progressivity that you're aware of.
Yes.
Which of those two would you choose for the state?
No, I feel very positive, say, about 2020, say something like the House Resources Committee has done. 2020 with a progressive feature is actually better than my 25-20 recommendation that I made originally to the governor. And the reason is that it is a much more balanced package, actually. What happens? Under very high prices, you collect more than 25-20, so you are protected in terms of windfalls. Then at average prices of $40 a barrel, you have the basic 2020 system that should lead to more investment, that should lead to companies being more eager to reinvest in Alaska. And then at very low prices, of course, 25-20 is more risky than 2020 because you're stuck with far more carry-forward credits. So I think a 2020 system with an appropriately designed progressive scale for oil and for gas is a superior system than, say, a simple 25-20 as I originally proposed. So consequently, that's also one of the reasons why I wholeheartedly support such an approach. I think it is simply a better approach. On the downside, less risk for the state. On average, more investment. And on the upside, you get something extra for the state so that there is no windfall. So on balance, I think 2020 with a well-designed progressive feature really is a better system than 25-20, I would say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kelly.
And I think that system has the element. I've always figured if we strike this just right and the price of oil that we read in the or here in the morning is $25, I'd like to not have to come into work early. And if I hear that it's $100, I'd like to not have to come into work early. So if this system will do both of those, that's the one I sure want. The oil companies are in some cases getting excused from a country or two around the world, and there's some nationalizing of the whole oil piece in some areas.
And I think I could argue that either way, but tell me what you think. Does that bode for more investment in Alaska just as a separate variable or less?
I do so. And in fact, in Chapter 2 of my report, I have described, you know, at some length what's going on internationally, because it was definitely one of the very important reasons for the recommendation of the PPT, as was stated also before, it collects more tax, and how am I relatively confident that this will work. That's precisely because of what is happening in other countries in the world, and Daniel Johnson, I think, also testified to that very very eloquently, I think, in his presentation. He described a world that I also described in my chapter 2, which is that the world is changing. The higher oil price is causing a number of governments to review their fiscal system. A number of governments are now considering higher taxes. In fact, we had the experience in Britain already with a significant increase in their government take from 40% to 50%. But other governments are also considering increases. We've seen Bolivia, we've seen Venezuela, we've seen Kazakhstan, countries, we've seen Trinidad and Tobago increasing their government take. So definitely other governments around the world are looking at the same thing Alaska is looking at, which is increasing government take, or at least making the system more progressive, so that as long as the high oil prices are there, that the state recover their fair share of the total revenues. So consequently, that's definitely something that's going on in the world. There's definitely now a trend to higher government take for oil. Not necessarily for gas yet, because there is so much gas around the world that there is still quite a bit of oversupply of stranded gas. So gas is still on the modest side. But for oil, for sure, we are on our way up with government takes. And that is why I think Alaska is making a modest change in the framework of what's happening worldwide. I expect more nations to join in higher government takes over the next 2 or 3 years. So all of that pictured in the recommendations that were made, and I think all of that pictured in the fact that Alaska can probably take significantly more revenues without seeing a dramatic decline in investment. And as the companies and my own analysis also confirms, with the 2020, you may even see an increase in investment. And that is definitely the case, in part because of what other nations around the world are doing.
Thank you, Dr. Van Meers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Van Meers, just a couple quick questions. First of all, neither version, the Senate resources or the House resources, have addressed the heavy oil, and we know that there's large oil accumulations of heavy oil up on the North Slope, specifically the Agnew Field and also at the Wessac Field, even though the lighter gravity at Wessac is being produced. There's still some lower gravity that isn't being produced and probably won't be unless there's some incentives. Do you think the 2020 or the 20% credit itself will be enough incentive to go after that heavy oil, or do you think these need to be dealt with, since the gravity rates are so different, need to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis, and an adjustment to the royalty would be a better solution? Or what is your thoughts to dealing with the heavy oil?
No, we discussed, of course, that we looked very carefully at stimulating heavy oil, and you are so right. There is probably about 3 billion barrels or 5 billion, in, according to some figures, of potential heavy oil or very viscous oil on the North Slope that still can be developed. depending on price conditions and depending on the adequate fiscal package. So definitely heavy oils is the future of Alaska, the future of the North Slope for sure, in terms of maintaining production. And consequently, that was a very important area for analysis, and for that reason, an entire chapter in my report was dedicated to it. The conclusion that we came to was that obviously, if you have higher tax credits for heavy oil, that will be an additional stimulus, and in fact, the companies originally were seeking that. Consequently, their view was that yes, additional credits, higher credits for heavy oils were beneficial for the development of heavy oil. And obviously that's the case. The higher you make the credits, the higher the rate of return for these heavy oils at this particular rate of return. That is a very important problem. Because of the long lead times and the high cost of the wells and the high cost of the processing of the heavy oil. So consequently, we looked at it very carefully. We came to the conclusion, as I also mentioned already before to Representative Guerra, that if you start pushing up these tax credits too high, the government simply becomes too exposed from a risk point of view. And consequently, although there could be merit in supporting somewhat more the heavy oil, the risk exposure for the government probably becomes unwise from an overall balance point of view. Then, reviewing the whole package, say 2020, for sure is a package that should in my view, definitely encourage heavy oil development, particularly in the international environment that we are, particularly with, as long as oil prices stay reasonably high, I can clearly see how 2020 would stimulate heavy oil development. As you correctly stated, heavy oil is not just one type of oil, it is a whole gradation of very extremely heavy oil to almost average grade oil. So obviously the higher the price, the more fiscal stimulus, the more of the heavy oil you produce. But for sure, in my view, the 2020 system will be a good system to take a good crack at these heavy oil deposits, should stimulate particularly the next round of development in that heavy oil and viscous oil. And hopefully, as long as oil prices stay relatively high, that could be a very worthwhile area for development in Alaska. And consequently, is there merit in stimulating heavy oil more? Of course there is, but the conclusion was it is just too risky to push these tax credits up too high. Literally for the same reason as I mentioned to Representative Guerra. We did quite a bit of risk analysis on that, and it's just becoming too risky if you push it too high.
Okay, and then thank you, Dr. Ben-Mears. And then lastly, the House Resources Committee is referring to WTI as the standard, whereas typically we use Alaska North Slope as our standard. And when we questioned Chairman Samuels about this, he had said that he was afraid currently the three producers up there could, since they control most of the oil production, that they could manipulate the ANS price. But yet, it's my understanding ANS price is based on the quality of the oil. And so I guess I'd just like to get your comment on if we should I think what they're saying is that the progressivity kicks in at $50 WTI. And I guess my question would be, is WTI the right standard to be using for Alaska North Slope oil?
Yes, there are advantages and disadvantages to using WTI versus ANS. ENS, as you correctly indicate, reflects better the actual characteristics, of course, of the North Slope crude. That's why it's called ANS. So consequently, the price of ANS reflects better the value of North Slope crude from time to time. And, you know, there is quite a bit of variation from month to month and day to day in say, the differential between WTI and ANS. So the advantage of using ANS rather than WTI is that ANS better reflects the value of the crude. Of course, ANS typically trails, say, $2 less than WTI, so that would also be a factor. There are also disadvantages using ANS, and that relates to two things. One, no matter what we do, there is eventually a decline projected for the North Slope crudes, and even with additional investment, it is likely that we will be producing less, say, ANS crude 20 years from now. Already, the level of production today doesn't really create a very, very transparent liquid market, and that problem is likely to go increase in the future. And consequently, also the idea that eventually, if the stranded gas contract comes forward, that the idea that we would lock this in for a particular period of time makes WTI a more reliable benchmark than ANS in that respect. So there are advantages and disadvantages to use either WTI or ANS, and you can use either of the two. If you use ANS, it is likely that at some time in the future you would have to switch back to WTI anyway, because the market simply may become too narrow to really create a reliable benchmark. But that is, you know, that remains to be seen. As I said, there are advantages and disadvantages using ANS and WTI. WTI, interestingly, is used worldwide in other fiscal regimes, even if the crudes have nothing to do with WTI, because WTI is such an important benchmark worldwide. Say, Colombia, which has absolutely nothing to do with the U.S. market or U.S. crudes, use WTI also for their windfall profit tax, their PPT-style feature. So it is not at all uncommon to use WTI as a benchmark, because it is such an international benchmark, and as long as the formula is designed reasonably, it could work. But I agree with you, there are advantages and disadvantages to using WTI.
Thank you.
Hey, Dr. Mears, you talked about locking in long term. Is that a normal procedure? Is that done elsewhere around the world to lock in tax programs over 20, 30 years? Is that normal?
Yeah,
Go ahead.
Sorry?
Go ahead.
Yes. The whole reason that the Stranded Gas Act, Development Act, permits, to the extent the Constitution permits, of course, locking in the tax system for a period of time, is because many other nations in the world are doing precisely that. And consequently, if you have a marginal gas project that has to compete with other projects around the world, obviously, fixed terms, reliable terms for the future, have an enormous risk reduction factor for the investors. If you never know what you have to pay over the next 30 years and you are faced with having to make a $20 billion investment, then that is a risk factor. And consequently, other nations in the world that have been very adept at exporting large volumes of gas, like Qatar, like Indonesia, like Malaysia, like Russia now in their Sakhalin deal, have, of course, guaranteed fiscal stability. So consequently, the fact that nations are actually locking in the terms for a considerable period of time, on average it is about 35 years around the world, for a considerable period of time, is an enormous attraction to investors to go forward with a very high-risk gas project. And that is, of course, the basis for the entire Stranded Gas Act. Now, what happens internationally is actually, if you sign the various contracts, like take, for instance, the Sakhalin contract, in Sakhalin, both oil and gas are being produced, and the fiscal stability is granted for both oil and gas. And the same, say, in Indonesia, if you produce condensates along with your gas, the fiscal stability is granted on the condensates as well as the gas. And the reason is, of course, that since oil and condensates and gas all come out together at the same time from the wells, if you have only fiscal stability on one fluid and not on the others, then you still really don't have much fiscal stability. So that was the argument for the sponsors to say, really, for us to make this worthwhile, we need fiscal stability on both, as is indeed customary around the world. So that is where this concept comes from. Does that mean that all gas export developments around the world have fiscal stability attached to it? No, not necessarily. Norway has no fiscal stability. Britain has no fiscal stability, which was in fact the reason why they could increase taxes from 40 to 50. Australia has no fiscal stability. So there are nations that are in the gas export business that have sufficiently profitable projects to permit no fiscal stability at all. In the case of Alaska, in view of the very, very low netback, very high transportation cost, obviously having fiscal stability would give this project an immense push forward. And that is what is really the core of this whole stranded gas contract. And that is also why it is so important to talk about this whole oil package, and that is why it is so important that the legislature is so carefully studying whether this package is indeed the right package, because later on, if it is tied up in a fiscal stability package, then the whole package has to work for Alaska for a while. And that is the concept, and that could make this whole gas line go along this significant new oil development. That's the view. That's kind of the philosophy. The international experience is abundant that fiscal stability helps push these large gas projects very much forward and put them on the top of the priority of investors, because investors just like fiscal stability, and it reduces enormous their exposure if they have to undertake the huge investments required for these kind of projects.
Thank you, Dr. Renmeer. Representative Kurtula.
Just a couple things. Dr. Van Meers, when you're talking about the profit-based system and it being used around the world, is it the same as the one that's being proposed to us, though? Is it really like the severance tax based on profits? Is it that same kind of system?
Each fiscal system around the world is actually somewhat different. The Alaska PPT for sure is not just a simple copycat of something that has been done somewhere else. Each profit-based system has to fit in, you know, the overall legislation of the country. For instance, to give you an example, Norway uses this PPT-style feature, but they don't have royalties at all. For instance, they don't have royalties. Now, if you have royalties, if you have very significant royalties like Alaska has, then obviously you have to design your profit-based system differently than if you don't have royalties at all. So consequently, here in Algeria, where I'm working right now at the moment, the profit-based system is also different. It is more aimed towards, say, distinguishing between smaller and larger fields, because that is very important in the Algerian situation. So each nation looks at its own situation, its own, you know, background, and then say, how can we implement a profit-based system of general international characteristics, but particularly suited to the environment that we are in? And that is what we try to do with this PP, to make a profit-based system that has the same overall philosophy of what other nations are doing, the same overall basic kind of goal, but not necessarily identical. There are some features in Alaska that are truly unique, I think, in the world concept, and that is the tradable tax credits. I think that is a very innovation for Alaska, which I think will really attract new investors. Norway tried to do something similar by giving refunds equal to the tax value of the losses. But I think Alaska is really more innovative in the area of tradable tax credits. So I think once the PPT is introduced, for sure other nations are going to look at Alaska and see how this functions and try to learn from Alaska, because I think we are on the forefront of this particular aspect of the PPT. Which is very interesting, I think, for new investors, for smaller companies to come in. And other nations are going to try to learn from that and compete with Alaska. But I think, you know, each PPT-style feature is somewhat different. It is based on the local economics, based on the local legislative system, whether there are royalties or no royalties, whether there are property taxes or no property taxes. Each system has so its own characteristics, and that is why we try to model the PPT based on international standards, but for the specific Alaskan environment. And I believe the fact that the companies agreed with the governor on the 2020 formula is proof that this was actually successful.
Representative Kutula.
But does any other country have a production tax based on profit rather than on the gross, where you're mixing the two?
It is very common that nations have three levels of taxation. In fact, I can give the example of Algeria right now. It is very common that nations have, one, a royalty based on gross value, then an extra tax based on the net value, as we are proposing for the PPT, and then corporate income tax. So many nations have these three levels of taxation: royalties, special tax based on net profits, and then corporate income tax. Examples of that are, for instance, Alberta, which uses that for the oil sands, Thailand, which has used that very successfully for the development of their gas in the offshore, so and Algeria, where I'm working right now. So consequently, this concept of having three main levels of taxation, royalties based on gross, a production tax or profit-sharing tax based on net, but with special characteristics, and then corporate income tax. That is quite common, and that is the formula we are trying to apply here.
Thank you.
Okay. Pedro, one other question. I don't know any other members. Cook Inlet. I think you've talked about Cook Inlet at different times, and I'd be curious as to what your thoughts are on a fix for Cook Inlet, if there is a fix.
Now, I believe that the Senate Resources Committee came up with a very good formula to, ensure that Cook Inlet producers, which are now at very low levels of production in many of the platforms, really are not hurt by this overall tax system. And I think the 5,000 barrel a day system, with a sliding scale going up to the 30,000, as proposed by the Senate Resources Committee, really was designed around Cook Inlet. And I think, although it of course applies equally for all of Alaska, it is a non-discriminatory system. Companies that are in the same economic situation on the North Slope will get the same benefits. But this system tailors very, very well with the specific situation that is in Cook Inlet and achieves two things. One, for those platforms which now produce very little, a few thousand barrels, sometimes a few hundred barrels per day, this tax will not really apply. So for those producers, there will be no tax. Yet those producers can benefit from the tax credits, tradable tax credits. So what Cook Inlet really needs is more exploration in deeper formations, maybe some more advanced development of reserves that are already there. And this PPT really stimulates that. So we should see some additional activity taking place in Cook Inlet as a result of the PPT. Of course, there will be some tax by the major players like Marathon and so on in Cook Inlet on gas, but that's what they have today. So I don't see much change in that picture. Basically, I believe that as a result of the PPT, there will be more investment in Cook Inlet and some modest, hopefully, expansion of the activities in the area.
Okay. Any other questions? It's about time for us to close out. I hear our bells are ringing. Dr. Van Meers, I appreciate you being here to help with the questions that we have. I'm sure there'll be more questions as time goes on. Later this afternoon at 1:30, we will be back here for HB 488. We will take testimony from Independents and Explorers, that being Pioneer, Andex Resources, Alaska Venture Capital Group, and Marathon Oil. With that, Representative Holmes, I'm glad to see you made it. He's been here for a while, and with that, we'll bring the meeting to a close and see you this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.